Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primecast. And this is a really exciting episode because happy anniversary! It's our anniversary episode, and joining me is none other than the man himself, Matt Wilson. How you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. Happy anniversary, Emmanuel. We really start this in March of last year.
Man, time flies when you're having fun, and that we are.
We certainly are.
So, I mean, where do we start? Like, I don't want to look backwards because there's so much to look forward to.
Oh man, there really is. It's hard to know where to begin right now with so many different bases to cover, but why don't we start with the app update?
Oh yeah. The War Machine app gets better every time I open it. I was just browsing it yesterday and I was like my jaw hit the floor, especially by comparison to like no, I don't want to throw shade on our old app, but the new app, you open it up and the rays come out of it. Oh, it looks so nice. It's all polished. I love it.
Yeah, it feels like that. It feels like every time I look at it, it's getting better. And I think it's just going to keep getting better, even though we've sort of taken this official step out of beta and into the full launch. I think it's going to feel like that for a long time. Like it just I think it's always going to be a work in progress, but sort of in the best possible way, maybe forever. We've got so many long-term plans for the app. There's features that we've announced, but then there's other things that we're going to do along the way that are just going to add more functionality or upgrades or enhancements to the way you play the game. So I feel like we've just sort of finished laying the foundation, but we've got a lot to build on.
Absolutely. It really does feel like culmination of just after years and years and years building to this point and then just so much more beyond it. So we've got subscriptions now. I'm diving into part four of Dark Rising right after this, and I cannot wait to start planning out my Black Tide campaign. I have John coming on later to talk more about that.
Yeah, and are you taking invaders or defenders in your campaign?
Oh, defenders all the way. I can't help but, protect the downtrodden and save us all. That's, it's the mission. It's the hero code. I can't wait. What about you?
Well, I would normally be with you. I'm more of a defender, but I am playing against my kid, and currently 0-2 against him as
Oh,
of
snap.
So he took the Storm Legion. So I'll be invading with the Sea Raiders this time.
Doesn't sound like you're doing a lot of invading to me. But you don't stand a chance against that kid. Like, if he's your kid,
Now I keep telling him just because you make the game doesn't mean you're actually good at it, but the mocking continues.
All right. So while you're suffering the humility of getting owned at your own game, what's coming next in the subscriptions?
All right, well, Wednesday this week, we'll be adding the first entry in our Heroes and Villains series, which is basically a deep dive into the backgrounds of the star characters in the game, the Warcasters, Solos, and those kinds of folks. The first one spotlights Capitan Ilari Borisyuk, who is our main hero in the Dark Rising storyline that is currently running in the app. And you get to find out what really makes him tick.
Ilari is awesome. He's a great character. So different than anything we've seen in Kador so far. And at the same time, he feels so familiar, so quintessently Kador.
He is, yeah. He's interesting because he's this very salt of the earth kind of character. He's very devoted to the motherland, but he's also different than, the conquest-driven warcasters that we've seen in the past from Kador. And what's really interesting to me about him, though, is that he's a late bloomer. His warcaster powers come to him when he's an adult, already in the military, and and a decorated sniper. And he's on his life path when all of a sudden his gift manifests and it totally changes his course, right? So he's still getting used to it when the Orgoth invade, which has been fun to see play out in the story because he's kind of learning warcasting on the job, but without a net. And we haven't really seen that before.
That's really awesome. I really can't wait to read that. I'm a total fluff nut. I read all of the fiction, I absorb it. I'm so excited. That's going to be so good. So, what else?
Well, we've got our first Battleforge scenario this week. So these are new scenarios each month where we're really trying to explore different fun ways to play the game that aren't just, scoring zones, right? And the first one is Kill the Messenger. And in it, both players are trying to get their own messenger across each other's battle lines. But the messenger has to check in at different points across the map to get to their to get like get their directions on where to go. So you're trying to keep your messenger alive while you hunt down your opponent's messenger, and it's a lot of fun.
I love the name. You can't see it right now, but I'm like grinning ear to ear. It sounds like a blast, right? So I can't wait to see what else is behind the next curtain.
Yeah, well, next week we've got the first compendium article. I've mentioned these before. These are super in-depth explorations of the different armies. They're being written by Jason Soles, and the first one is all about the Orgoth Sea Raiders. And it's funny because originally we were approaching these articles as just more sort of compact essays on a particular subject. And I'd asked Jason to write a piece on Orgoth warjacks. And he comes back with like this 8, 10-page encyclopedia on the history of Orgoth, societies organized and the different paths of the war witches all ruled over by the witch queen. And it was fantastic. And I was totally blown away.
That's so
But I was
Jason.
like, I just wanted 1,000 words on warjacks, Jason. And he's like, well, I had to give you all the other stuff so you understand the warjacks. So I said, okay, well, now you have to do that for Storm Legion and Winter Court. So get
Well, he walked right into that one.
Yes, he did.
So that's amazing. I'm super excited. I can't believe we're going to have this kind of regular new content like every week, every month.
Yeah. Every Wednesday, we'll be adding new material to the library. We want everyone to have something new to look forward to on a regular basis and to feel like that subscription is worthwhile. And the app, the game itself is free along with the model content, which in the past you had to buy through card decks or books. The subscriptions would allow us to keep developing the world out and create things like the campaigns and the scenarios. So we really hope that it's something everybody enjoys and wants to subscribe to, because the more support we have for the subscriptions, the more we're going to be able to do with the content that we put into the app.
And then along with that content, you're getting unlimited saved slots for your forces, like unlimited saved for your matches, cloud storage. So you can use the app from any of your devices too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. On top of all that library content, you've got some very practical and desirable features, especially being able to connect from whatever device you're in front of at the moment. Like I migrate between my phone, my iPad, my laptop, and desktop all day long, depending on, what I'm working on or where I'm at. And I'm constantly reaching for my iPad right now because it's the only device I have running the app. So I can't wait to be, untethered and just be able to access it from anywhere.
That sounds nice. And we had some announcements about the desktop support last week, right?
Yeah, we've had quite a few updates over the last couple of weeks. And just this last week, we made a big update to our development roadmap. The one significant change was that we started getting into the print support, because we know a lot of people want to be able to print out force lists and cards. We realized that the best way to make it happen, though, was to get the desktop computer support into the app first. Neither of those features were part of the original scope of the app, so this is something we've had to add along the way. And as we figured this out, we had to revise the order of those things in the way that we were planning on releasing them. So next month in April, we should get desktop support, and you'll be able to get the app through Steam for Mac OS or Windows. And then about a month later, we'll have the print to PDF functions in there.
Dang, that's awesome. It just keeps getting better and better. But we've got even more good news over the past week, haven't we?
Yeah, the Winter Core starters showed up in stores last Friday.
Oh, snap! They weren't alone.
That's right. No, they had company. The original release wave included Horus the Thousand Wraths, Major Anthony
Nice.
Wolf, and Captain E. Katarina Baranova, as you know. But we decided to go ahead and ship the 6 mercenary solos with them. So what released on Friday was kind of a 1.5 waves. So we're making up a little ground.
Epic. The mercenaries are great. There's something for everyone and then some. So then the individual warjacks that were originally supposed to ship with the mercenaries are next.
Exactly. Yeah, the warjacks are big, chunky pieces with a ton of parts, so they are very time-consuming to produce. We're expecting to have them ready to ship within a few weeks, and that wave will also include the Journeyman League kits, which I know people are getting really excited for because they've seen the new universal widget coming from Broken Egg Games that make up the kit.
The Universal Widget makes it so easy to check those like super common distances. And then the Journeyman League has always been just the best way to introduce people to the game. If you want to like teach a friend or your partner how to play the game, there's just no better way than easing them into the experience through the Journeyman League. We're going to grow your army just like one or two models at a time over several weeks. It's so much fun because you're learning new things about the game each time, unlocking that arcane knowledge of being a warcaster along the way. But then you can't wait to play the next week because you're going to get to put a new model into your army in a unit and something that is going to completely change your game. And I one thing I really like about it is that you get to pull people into your story. Like each part of the way, it is changing your story and everybody else becomes a part of it.
It's true. It's true. And if your local game store is running the league, you can get one of those sweet widgets.
Yes. So everyone should check with their local game store. And then if you haven't ordered one of the kits, then what?
So we have special order for retailers with that wave, where if they placed a certain minimum order, they got two of the Journeyman kits for free, which is enough
Oh.
widgets for eight people, or they could purchase them separately or add on more if they needed them. But if your store isn't expecting them, they can email our valiant president, Sherry Urey, at sherry@privateerpress.com. And that's Sherry at privateerpress.com. And they can inquire about the Journeyman kit and she'll help them get it.
That's awesome. And Cherry is super delightful, so I know that she is gonna get that kit to him right away. So, all right, we've covered the app development and the new releases from the past week. Is there more? What else is coming?
Well, we've got Adepticon coming up, right?
Oh,
We're
yeah.
running the first of our legendary events there. It's the Battle of Blackroot. We've talked a bit about this already, and we put an insider up about it last week. It's a very cool event with a big multiplayer main game, and the whole thing ties into two other events that will be at Gen Con and Warfare Weekend. And then the results of all the events will determine what happens with this Orgoth artifact that is going to get revealed, both in the setting as well as on the tabletop.
That is wild. Real impact in the setting and on the tabletop is my favorite way to interact with the game. Like, that is every player's dream.
Yeah, that's right. And then hopefully, not too far past Adepticon, we're going to see House Kallus join the fight, which I know has a lot of people excited.
They can't get here soon enough.
Don't I know it? Let's see. And then as the first Dusk army wraps up, we'll hopefully be right on time with our first Warlock army, and that's the Brine Blood Marauders.
What? The Brine Blood Marauders and the crowd goes wild. Ah, I'm so excited. Let's talk about those Trollkin pirates.
Well, I know I've gushed a little about them previously. I can't stop, really. On our last Primecast Plus, we teased out some of the concept artwork for them, but that was really just a morsel. This new army is one of the greatest, craziest things that we've ever done in War Machine. It's just overflowing with character and some of the most hilarious and fun minis you've ever seen. And we've always had a lot of fun with the Trollkin. So if you like Trollkin and you like pirates, this is like really a dream come true.
So on Primecast Plus, we showed off Admiral Boomheller. And that's a name we know really well, and she is rocking an epic sword.
Yeah, well, so everybody knows Gregor Boomhauer, right? The original War Machine mercenary Fellcaller. And he's always been kind of a ham, right? He fancies himself the front man for his gang, and he thinks very highly, maybe too highly, of his own talent. And we really got to see that whole bit really overflow in his two incarnations in Riot Quest, where Boomhauer just wants all eyes on him. He's the life of the party, the center of attention.
The solo artist himself. Yeah, I've had a lot of fun with him in Riot Quest, just mowing stuff down. And I just have a big heart for Boomheller, one of my very first mercenary. I actually, was it my first mercenary? It might have been one of my first mercenary units ever, like, period. And I have subsequently painted it over and over again because you gotta customize your mercenaries to each one of their armies, right? And so Boomheller just, he always found his way in there, and I'm so excited.
So, well, it turns out Gregor Boomhauer has a big sister. And maybe the reason that he's such a glutton for attention is that he spent his whole life trying to get out from under her shadow. Because let me tell you, Admiral Boomhauer she's bigger than life.
That's amazing. How do you go bigger than Boomheller, right? Boomheller's big sister.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's in command of this entire Brine Blood Marauder fleet. They've got this secret base, really, like this entire fortress colony deep down in the Alkyr subcontinent south of the Iron Kingdoms. And actually, in our next Iron Kingdoms RPG project, Into the Deep Wild, there's even quite a bit of info on the Brine Bloods and a good chunk of info about the Admiral herself, which is pretty quickly becoming everybody's favorite character.
And so, what's in the rest of her fleet? Does she just pirate up and down the coast of the Iron Kingdoms?
We've really pushed the concepts for what's going to be in the Brian Blood Marauders. You've seen the concept art for the War Beasts. The Marauder crew, their sort of main infantry, that's going to be in the core starter. They're great. It's 10 unique sculpts that make up these two units of Marauders. And then they have different command attachments like the bosun and the quartermaster that are all so much fun to look at. And they're command attachments and they give the units these great abilities. And there's the galley crew, which is like this trio of pygmy Trollkin cooks or chefs that are running around trying to find dinner for their mateys. And we've got the surgeon, who's really the ship's carpenter, but for some reason, since he's got a big saw, it means he's like good at fixing you up if you're wounded.
That is the best, most flavorful context. It's like when you're the butcher, the barber, the surgeon, and everybody's fixer-upper.
That's right. He can fix anything, even you. And there's more, right? Since they're seagoing pirates, they're not going to have conventional cavalry. So instead, their version, right, is they've got these pygmy troll assault ballooners floating over the battlefield, dropping bombs.
Troll King Sky Pirates.
And we're going to double down on that for their big 80 millimeter solo too. Just wait till you see it.
No way. That sounds amazing. But then we've got another Warlock army coming as well, and it looks like their logo just showed up on the new roadmap as well as in Primecast Plus.
That's been our biggest secret for quite a while. And we really teased something big at the end of the last Primecast Plus, like you said.
What was that? Like, it was like the Mighty Morphin Dragon Warriors?
For the logo, yeah, basically. This is a whole new faction for Mark IV. And we showed the logos of each of the armies in the faction. And when they're combined, they form the faction logo. So it was like two small dragon heads, and then you smash them together, and it becomes one big dragon head.
That is awesome. And we haven't done that before, so that's relevant. And then, of course, you said dragons. That's my favorite word.
So our operating name for the faction for like the last 18 months or so has been Double Dragon, which of course is an awesome 80s arcade reference.
Nice.
But for us, it was a bit more literal. So for anyone that followed the finale of the Henchhold Scroll, you might remember that Ryas and Saren, the Talons of Everblight, were there. And Saren kind of tried to go through that big gate, and it didn't seem to go so well for her.
Yeah, she just got zapped out of existence.
Right. Except, of course, like all Legion warlocks, she had a shard of Bothink in her, right? And those things are basically indestructible. So I promised our team I wouldn't give away the farm on this, but this new faction, which calls themselves the Chimera, is what happens when Ryas recovers Saren's Bothink and they finally decide to cut ties with Everblight once and for all.
Double dragons!
Double dragon.
So the Chimera, is this going to be more Legion of Everblight? Do Ryas and Saren run off with half the Legion army? How does that work?
No, so the only remnant of Legion in the Chimera are Ryas and Saren. Everything that will be part of both of the armies are their creation. There's no conscripts or enslaved races. Everything is by their design. And I have to tell you, I can't wait to be able to show off what we're doing with them because you haven't seen anything like it before. It's hideous and it's beautiful all at the same time. And we took a really crazy direction with it because you see, when Saren touched the gate and it kind of blew up around her, the Othink, her Othink got changed. There was a lot of Cirrus stuff hitting this crazy cosmic dragon soulstone, and stuff happened and changed them. And the concepts that we've been working with are just super cool looking there. And the two armies are like this, they kind of have this yin yang thing where two sides of the same coin, two aspects that complement each other, two halves of the whole, like Ryas and Saren.
That is the sound of me picking my jaw up off the floor. Hold on. Oh my God. What? That's amazing and so much to take in.
It is. Man, I think this might be our longest segment ever.
Yeah, probably.
With that, I think that's a high note to leave on. So happy anniversary, my friend. It's been a hell of a year, and it's looking like we've got a lot more fun ahead.
Absolutely. We got a great anniversary episode in store for you. Next up, we've got Jason Soles and Eric Ryerson joining for some War Machine Mark IV discussion. After that, I've got John Smith to talk about the new league. And then right after that, some Monster Apocalypse talk. So stick around for more. Want to say roll drums?
You know what? I'm gonna let you say it.
Roll the drums! Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, I have some very special guests. I have Jason Soles and Eric Ryerson joining me to talk about War Machine Mark IV and some of the goodies coming ahead of us. Jason, Eric, how's it going?
It's going good. How's it going?
Hey, privateers.
Nice. Great to have you both back. Two of my favorite people, and exceptionally excited to talk about this topic because. As we were talking about a little bit backstage, there's some really exciting things coming to War Machine that we know people are going to be having huge reactions to.
Well, that's right. And your use of huge is, of course, apt for battle engines are going to all find a home in prime armies going forward. And we'll
Woo!
also see the casters as well find homes in legacy primeless.
That's exciting. I know that everybody's waiting to hear what's going to happen with battle engines. So, can we talk a little bit about that? What's the thought process behind it? How do they get introduced?
Well, right from the beginning, we knew any of our larger, more exciting models, we didn't want to leave out of any part of the game. So from the beginning, we planned on implementing them, where we needed to sort of wait until the things settled a bit before adding such a large thing to the game and making sure the new armies had some options sort of available by then that could help them out on parity and equity with ability to present something large of their own.
At one point, we were actually considering waiting until the new armies actually received their first battle engines before releasing the legacy ones. But we also came to realize that we just introduced those new 80 mm solos and that there was already a degree of parity, so that we might as well get them out there sooner than later.
Absolutely. That way everybody gets to play with their biggest, most exciting models. And I know as a, historied War Machine player, it's always something that draws people over to the table, whether you're doing demos or you're playing in an event. There are just really impressive models in the privateer line that are on those huge bases, and we have some great sculpts and now the opportunity to get them back on the table and get them played again.
So we've been rebalancing all of them for Mark IV, obviously. And in addition to the battle engines, the structures are coming in at about the same time. And behind them, not too distantly, are going to be the Colossals and Gargantuans. That's taking it's taking a little more playtest time, though. So they're on deck and they're in playtest, but they're a little slower coming.
That's exciting. I know that's exciting for me to hear, and I'm sure everybody out there who is hearing that as well, getting their Colossals and Gargantuans, we're within that milestone. So something to look forward to right around the corner and then a little further off in the distance.
Additionally, we'll have Secret Dominion out very shortly. They're sort of unique as they're the first army where, since they're the second army, sort of like Ravens was, the theme that we had most available to make a second Circle army didn't quite have as many models as we would have liked to make a full army option. So we actually added a secondary sub theme to help bulk it out. So you will actually see the Wolfsworn present in that army. Similarly, we ran into the same issue with the Mage Hunter army coming in the future for Retribution. So the Elowir forces will be padding that out and giving enough options to really make an army that's on the same scale as the other options available.
Man, that's really exciting. I love to see that because it means that there's so much that can be included and so many different options, and seeing some of those smaller options combine to really flesh out an army is, I think, just exactly what we wanted to see. So,
We also ensured that one of the casters available for each army will be in theme with that sub theme. So it won't be three wold
ooh.
based casters and then the wolf sworn, on the side, feeling sort of out of place. Similarly with the Elowir.
So, Grail got a pretty good reworking.
That was a mic drop. I like how he just Grail got a pretty good reworking.
Okay. I'm not really sure after that mic drop moment what I actually want to say here. Well, I could say that, so for example, Grail picked up Leadership Wolfsworn that grants Prowl and Sidestep along with the Fog of War spell so that his forces can now approach from under the cover of stealth.
I think we'll also see a lot more skinwalkers on the table than any previous edition.
Yeah.
That is terrifying. And I love skinwalkers, so those sculpts are amazing. Those models are so sweet. I want to see them so much.
I've always thought so, too.
All right. So I did have a topic that I wanted to throw at you here at the end. It's going to be a little impromptu. So listeners, you're going to hear me put the developers a little bit on their toes and ask them some questions about the individual armies themselves. And so I don't want to get too much into the weeds. We don't have a whole lot of time to dive super deep, but I would like to know in your mind how you see each of these armies coming together as a whole. So put a bow on it and say, what is Orgoth Sea Raiders?
I mean, from face value, they're a very aggressive and offensive army, and you'll see a lot of things trying to get things closer. One thing I really like about them in the design process to encourage that is an initial playtest. The support units, the War Witches, were standing in the back supporting the Jacks. The Jacks would go in and you'd have these models in the back, and it didn't feel very Orgoth Sea Raiders. Mm. However, their ability to grant Dark Shroud encourages them to be within melee range of whatever the army's fighting. So now you have this support unit that's actually also running up the board with the force, even as a vanguard to ensure they're getting the negative armor on the enemies that are about to be charged. And I really like that dynamic and how it plays on the table.
Yeah, that feels really Orgoth.
We're also starting to explore some of the fluff behind them and dig into some of the background of the characters, which we'll be exploring in fiction releases inside the app. And it's really interesting to start playing with these, the characters, the warcasters specifically, who sometimes could have lived, you know, dozens, hundreds, or thousands of past lives, and how that bleeds over into the present. Horsk, for instance, has a pretty dramatic history. He's been to Western Imran before, and this is not his first rodeo, and we're going to explore the pitfalls of serial immortality.
Oh, snap. That is, you know, bravo, gentlemen. I love how you set me up totally before this. They're like, I have no idea what we're going to talk about. Like, it will totally just be a total surprise, and I think I'm going to get them on their back foot, and they just come out swinging. That was exactly what I was looking for. Thank you so much for that. So let's do more of that. Let's talk about Storm Legion. Eric, give me the crunchy on Storm Legion.
Storm Legion very much promotes that combined arms approach, despite having very strong and stable warjacks on its own. Wolf sort of almost enforces it, where if you want to take full advantage of his feat, you're going to need things to die, or at least tie up the opponent to encourage them to kill things. And I like what his feat becomes with, where you're almost harming yourself to harm his army. Mm. And having the infantry, it's like you could take the more elite infantry that's a little more expensive and can absolutely wreck jacks. However, their budget infantry are actually very strong and very good value for what you get. And they can also enhance his feat and hold things up. You jump to Debarrow, and her feat helps everyone, jack and infantry alike, ending up being very strong for infantry that don't have quite as many available buffs to them. And having all of their damage rolls and all their attack rolls get things makes you think about other interactions too, such as like electroleaps and things that normally with ionization, it's like, wow, now those are actually really hurting things. They can actually harm lightjacks pretty successfully. Mm. And things that didn't normally have that impact start spreading around. We tried to help the lightning theme overall to make sure everyone had a place to apply themselves without overdoing it and still giving them enough options in case they fight a mirror match where things are lightning resistant or something, which gets into, we definitely wanted to remove immunities, I guess. Resistance seems way better. I remember having very poor matchups in previous editions where it's like, I have a bunch of fire-typed ranged attacks and their caster is immune to fire. It's like, well, this will be an odd assassination. I'm not really sure. What
well, and I'm glad we're still fighting.
Oh man, Jason, you're really up against it now. He just gave me all the whole Storm Legion goods, so you're gonna have to give me something juicy too.
I'll say that I just finished a compendium article on the Storm Legion. I think those compendium articles, they asked me for 1,500 words, and I turned over between 5,000 and 8,000.
Oh, I love it. Yes.
So it's definitely a pretty solid deep dive, and it's going to fill in the history of Signar over at least since Requiem and the evolution of the Storm Legion through the new Galvanic Renaissance. The same sort of articles are planned for all the new armies, so you'll get updates that bring everything into alignment with the present day, which is slightly nebulous in that there are some dramatic beats we want to, you know, kind of suspend. For instance, Signar's poor king has contracted a plague and has been lying on his deathbed for, well, a few minutes now.
Oh, no.
So his two young sons, quite possibly the inheritors to the Relthorn crown in coming days.
Oh, snap. Drama ensues.
Yeah. Let's go.
Let's go. All right. Jason, that is awesome. That gives people something to look forward to. I love reading your stuff. You get way deep. When you talk about deep dive, you're going scuba diving, man. So that's so exciting. And I'm going to read every word of it. So can't wait to hear that. Eric, do you want to kick us off with some Winter Core?
I guess when going for the design elements of Winter Core, we wanted to establish the most Kaedoran aspects throughout their army. And we looked at some of the things they had in the past for reference between the Grey Lords and Commandants and Widowmakers, and sort of found things that were uniquely Kaedor that we could emphasize and theme around to sort of get a new vibe that was different from what we had in the other armies. And you'll see Boris Yuk and Ekaterina and Ilari will have very strong that Commandant commanding the army and getting more out of the troops, which I love. He's my favorite of the new Winter Core casters.
He is awesome.
Redoing the Mana War was very tricky, trying to find something that people like that would be good on the table, that would fit the correct role for the army, and still represent what it's supposed to be both in the lore and in the game. This modernization, but not necessarily just adding bigger guns and more layers of armor, but something more streamlined for the new army. And I think the suppressors shook out through much playtest in a really good spot. They're one of my favorite units in the game. And the Winter Corps really represent that dogged infantry that, you know, swapping the weapons around, doing whatever they can for whatever situation, and making the backbone of the force. And I feel the Jacks also landed in a very Kaedoran spot, where we don't have a light and a heavy. We have a heavy and an extra heavy.
Well, and you said dog, but they actually have a hunting dog, right?
They do. They have a puppy.
Oh, and adorable. I love it.
Well, might be an understatement, a puppy, but that puppy will scout things out and reveal targets for their snipers to take shots.
And by puppy, we mean like full-grown wolf.
Yeah, a dangerous hunting mastiff or whatever, but
I mean, there have basically been puppies in the game. The old, I mean, it's a big step up from the old Kaedoran dog, so I think it's awesome. I love seeing it. You're right, you hit on that theme where it feels very home to Kaedor, but it feels also new and, you know, that next generation, that modern warfighter. I'm excited to see it. Jason, what's behind curtain number three?
So I think the Winter Corps are my favorite new army in terms of considering their background and the story behind them. It's the first time we see Kaedoran's back foot. They're, instead of being the aggressors out to conquer their neighbors, the Orgoths slam into them hard. And for the first time, we see Kaedor really losing territory. And they have this new citizen army and kind of are worked into a much more being the protagonists of the story. And so we had to stop and kind of think about how to make them more sympathetic and dig into them as these defenders really having to reach out and ask for help if they can get it from their enemies who just kind of despise them for their, you know, decades or even centuries of aggression. And their story is, it's pretty dark, where the rest of the Iron Kingdoms go into this kind of glorious new golden age. Kaedor is really struggling. It comes out of the Infernal War with just a loss of their greatest heroes, where Signar kind of invites the remnants of the Convergence in and starts to really expand its industries with all this technology and lore that they're gaining from the Thamorites, etc. Kaedor almost immediately is on the cusp of a civil war. The great princes understand that with the death of Vladimir Zepeski, that the Vanars and the Zepeskis have just united in the birth of a child, and that the two mightiest lines in Kaedor suddenly emerged, and that great princes understand that their time is sunsetting, and the stakes just get higher and higher and higher until they boil over. And there's a companion article coming out to explain all that.
And deeper we dive. That's really awesome. I really like to see how people have turned on Kaedor over the years. Not that I'm against, because I'm a diehard Kaedor player myself. And you see things like the Butcher, also along things like their very militant backbone and structure and how it clashes in the stories. And now we get to see some of the results in the future. And some of my favorite books ever written are exactly that, you know, formula of like, here's the lead up and here's the consequences.
It's real interesting because Kaedor had kind of this pragmatic approach to taking every tool at their disposal, whether they were ancient Orgoth weapons or, you know, whatever edge they can get, wherever they could find it, they adopted it. Mm-hmm. But that meant that, for instance, their Grey Lords were digging into Infernal lore at the time the Infernals arrived. Mm-hmm. And their Doom Reavers are armed with weapons that are, you know, Orgoth weapons.
Yeah.
And soul-powered, will-crushing weapons. And suddenly their enemies understand these tools better than they do and can turn them on them. So suddenly they have to jettison so much of what's become just part of their toolbox. And the Butcher really kind of does look like an antiquated relic of a past state. I mean, there's no real place for that sort of character in the new Kaedor. It's a brave new world and one full of Orgoth.
Well, it's interesting to see how like the coming of the Orgoth affects a faction that was already dipping a toe in with the Orgoth and in some of it unwittingly. Awesome, awesome, awesome. I didn't think that was going to get any better, and somehow yet we escalated further. Dare I ask for Dusk, Eric?
Whew. All right, we're getting to a lot of stuff that people haven't seen yet.
I know, we're toeing the line.
I guess
close though.
Yeah, I know, we're very close. One of the things that I've heard asked a lot is why Mat 6, and the answer is really presented throughout the army. And
why Mat 6? What, Eric?
Why Mat 6 on their
what
Eidolon?
Mat 6?
The Eidolon is Mat 6, where everyone else got Mat 7 on their heavy, and a lot of people have been curious as why. Why is this high advanced faction somehow less accurate when they don't really seem to have to hit buffs? And that is because between ready availability of Kiss of Lilith, Curse of Shadows, Dark Shroud, and other damaging effects, their damage is through the roof, their survivability is strong, and each Jack has a third weapon on it. And with all Jacks having dual attack, they have more combat output for the chassis. And the one way we could curb them and differentiate them from the other armies we found, and a hit bonus is truly a damage bonus when you think about it and how you apply your percentage of average damage. So it was one way to curve them back and balance them with the others in an indirect way. Well, very direct actually, but a different way than the others had their abilities available to them.
I'll throw in also from the background side of things, their technology's taken a hit, whereas they're kind of benefiting from both Vire and Shael. They lost the living, and they lost huge numbers of their occult researchers and their arcane mechanics, And they're really playing catch up these days. They're not in the same advanced state as they once were. They're rebuilding their whole society, let alone their production output.
Interesting. Everybody's taking a different course. And that's exactly, I mean, how the story has to evolve. But seeing it unfold both within the actual models themselves and then the themes and story behind it, man, that just, it gets me so pumped for Mark IV.
Heck yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think that brings us right to the end of this section. Thank you both for giving me such an amazing segment. Thank you for giving the listeners something awesome to take with them and be excited about. There's so much to dive in and dissect in this short amount of time. Is there anything you'd like to say as parting shots, Jason?
I would say look for those compendium articles, which are coming real soon.
Oh, yeah.
They have a sizable amount of lore catching up the setting, devoted catching up the setting.
Nice. How about you, Eric? Any parting shots?
I mean, there's just so much to look forward to. We're trying to get out all of these prime legacy armies as fast as possible. We have so many in the hopper ready to push through the last bits of playtest. We have battle engines. We have colossals and gargantuans. We have dusk rules. We have things to reveal about the two new warlock-led armies. There's just so much coming in the next few months. I can't even fathom the timeline of it, but there's a lot ahead.
You are not kidding. A whole tsunami of things to come. And as far as this episode, it's not over yet. Next up, we've got some Warcaster followed by some Monsterpocalypse talk. So stick around after the drums. Gentlemen, you want to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Jason's like, nah.
I'm good.
That ain't me, Doug.
All right. Excellent. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, I am joined with John Smith from, well, I guess now working on this league. And we're going to talk a little bit about Black Tide, a little more detail. How you doing today, John?
I am spectacular. My excitement level is through the freaking roof right now.
Woo! Let's go. I love it. Heck yeah. High energy. I'm sure it's been a lot of fun and a lot of just exciting moments to work on Black Tide. And now we finally get to share it with everyone else. So why don't you take it away? Tell me a little bit about the crunch and let's start right from the get-go.
Absolutely. So I want to go ahead and shout out. I usually refer to myself as the co-writer of this campaign because Lauren and Jason and Matt have been amazing help during this. And we have an incredible group of playtesters I've gotten to know over this process who have given fantastic feedback. So huge team effort. Awesome. What is Black Tide? Black Tide is it's going to be a narrative campaign that you'll access through the subscription and the War Machine app. So it's part of the whole bundle where you're getting like the lore and all the other drops you get on the subscription. You'll get access to the narrative campaign. And by narrative campaign, what I mean is these scenarios are not like War Machine that you're used to. This is not your steamroller format. This is not really a tournament type thing. These are really deeply story-driven missions. And they're actually built to follow the Dark Rising story that Aaron Riddell has been putting out in the app. And that story follows the arrival of the Orgoth onto the shores and their clash with Kador as this massive invasion force sort of hits the Iron Kingdom and just starts taking over territory. Awesome. So what we wanted to do was let you guys, as the players, sort of reenact that.
That sounds great. I think that's really interesting that it's going to line up with what Aaron Riddell's been putting out. And I love narrative stuff. It's one of my favorite ways to interact with any game is the opportunity to participate in part of a story and also, you know, to kind of build up and have things go deeper and get more complicated as the league goes.
Yeah, I mean, I originally fell in love with this hobby because of the whole narrative stuff, the idea of telling stories on a tabletop. And it's been a real deep passion of mine for a long time. And I'm incredibly excited that we get to do this whole system for War Machine with it now. So the way the campaign is going to work is you as the player, you just kind of round up all your friends, locals, your mortal enemies, whoever you're playing the games with. And you guys will pick which role you want to have. So there's two roles in the game. There's the invaders and the defenders, and it's pretty self-explanatory. The campaign in its entirety, this season one, as we're calling it, season one is Black Tide, is going to be 9 scenarios, 3 chapters of 3 scenarios each.
Nice.
And in each scenario, you're going to have there will be a different task for the invader and a different task for the defender. These are very, very seldom will they be symmetrical scenarios. They're very asymmetrical. So one of my favorite scenarios is a beach landing. So it's this whole invasion force coming off the boats on the shore. The defenders are fighting to push them back to the sea while the invaders are trying to fight through and reach the back lines of the defender.
Nice. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is nuts. It has been a ton of fun to come up with and a ton of fun to play test and refine over this whole process. So what you do then is, as you play through the scenarios, you'll earn points for what we call your war chest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get into that a little bit more later on. For season one, the big thing about the war chest is it will determine narratively how your army does in the scope of the invasion. So at the very end of the campaign, you'll keep track of your points per player, and you'll get points for playing the game. You get some points for winning the game. You'll get more points for winning by scenario versus something like cast or kill.
Interesting.
And periodically, you'll run into what's called a key battle, and those are worth a bunch of points.
So which side do you like to play on? Are you an invader?
I am 100% an invader.
Of course you are.
That's just my personality, you know?
Why not?
Yeah.
So that's awesome. And you get to build up a war chest. I love the idea of being able to like build up, get deeper into the game, and also be able to like look at the leaderboard and see where my stats are.
Yes. For you people who like to be competitive with your others, the war chest is your way of determining who at your store, in your club, really won the scenario in the end.
Nice.
But for everybody, at the very end of the campaign, we're going to put out a series of endings, and you'll figure out which ending you got by which role you took and what your war chest was at the end of the show.
That's awesome. So it could be different for everybody then.
Absolutely.
That's the best part, right? Everybody gets their own ending.
Yeah.
So
I really want this to be custom for you guys, individualized, you know.
That's a really cool idea. I like the idea that everybody gets their opportunity to tell their own story and end it reflective of how they played it. You know, that way there's no cookie cutter, you know, canned, here's what you get. Very cool. So what about future seasons?
Future seasons. So some very keen-eyed peoples have noticed on the timelines that have been put out that there's reference to more of the narrative seasons in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So season one that's launching, I guess, right now. Season one is sort of an introduction to how the system is going to work and sort of show you guys what we're trying to do with it. When we move into season two, we're going to integrate a lot of really cool stuff into it. Things like in-store league support.
Oh.
So you can play the campaign on your own with your buddies, but if you want to get together and run it at a store as part of a league, we'll have materials for that. We'll have individualized models for that. We've teased the Gobber Spy. Mm-hmm, it's going to have to do with the something to do with the campaign there. And then as we advance along in the seasons, those war chest points are not just going to be for bragging rights. You're going to be able to spend those to enhance your army.
Oh, very cool. I like upgrades.
Yeah. So not only are they going to determine narratively how your army does, but you might get to pull out some cool buffs, maybe some command cards, extra units, just little things to give you an edge and sort of mold your army to match what's happening with them in the narrative.
That's super cool. So overall, we've gotten a, you know, look from the top down, but what's your favorite part? If you were to pull out one thing and share your personal excitement for the league, somebody who's already participated in it, what's your favorite?
That's a tough one.
I always ask the tough questions here on Primecast.
I'll say my favorite part so far as the main writer on this has been the reaction from the playtesters.
Mm.
And my favorite comment I've gotten out of this whole thing was we finished up a playtest game and one of my playtesters was like, this doesn't play at all like War Machine. This is like totally new.
That's exciting.
And everybody got hyped up. It was really awesome. Like it's absolutely War Machine. It's the game that we all love. It's the game we're all used to, but it's played in a different way so that it becomes a whole new experience.
I love it. I'm so excited. I can't wait to try it.
Yeah. So as the person building this, that is what gets me the most excited. As a player, what gets me the most excited, and I'm going to put this as a teaser, is the last scenario.
Oh.
Because it is a narrative. We are building to something. There's this big surge of energy and all these clashes of forces, and it has to come down to a boiling point. And that scenario is one of my favorite scenarios I've ever written.
Oh. Dun, dun, dun. Teaser achieved.
Spoiler-free zone.
Nice. I love it. I know whatever your crazy mind has come up with is going to be fun and exciting. And you always reach for the stars to exceed whatever you touched last. So I know this is not going to be any exception.
Appreciate it, man. I'm really excited to see what the community does with it and how they take it. Because as a reminder, these are ultimately just suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys can play these scenarios in your homes, in your game stores, and there's a bunch of special rules we've written for this, so you can pull out your favorites, make your own stuff, and hopefully inspire people to play this game in a really cool, fun kind of narrative sort of way.
Yeah, most definitely. I think that it gives people the opportunity to also bring in other people and say, be part of my story.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
So, super cool. I'm excited to see what's next. I'm on the edge of my seat. You know, I love hanging out with you, John. It's just a blast having you on Primecast.
I love being here, man. Thank you.
No problem. So we got a little time here at the end. Do you have any parting shots? Anything you want to talk about? Like, what are you playing? What's on your table? If you're playing Invaders, is that Orgoth?
It is Orgoth.
Of course it's Orgoth. Yes.
If you've been following the War Machine Facebook group, you've probably seen some of my Orgoth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just got the variant standard bear. Actually, I'm looking at him right now. It just painted him up.
Nice. I can't wait to see it. I know that you go just as hard on your paint jobs too. So super cool.
I am ready to invade the Iron Kingdoms. Absolutely.
So what do you play? Let's get into a little crunch. What's your, who's your Warcaster?
Well, at the moment, I've still got Horsk,
mm-hmm.
the original guy. Because for those of you that know me, you know I'm more of a hobbyist than I am a gamer. So I've been frantically painting everything. And I'm still waiting on the actual army box. I haven't received that one yet. My past few months have been very, very filled with mostly writing scenarios, doing development on Warcaster, and just a lot of really good hobby development goodness.
Nice. Let's take a quick detour into Warcaster Town.
Oh, that's dangerous territory.
I like danger. I'd say it's my middle name, but we know it's not. Right now, my middle name is Hobby, and my hobby is getting you to tell me more about Warcaster. So let's dive in. Tell me what you've been touching on Warcaster.
So for Warcaster, the main things that we're pushing on for this year, we've got the organized play
mm-hmm.
that's coming out in the summer. And we've got the Lost Legion that's going to be coming out, I believe, at the end of this year. I'm not quite sure on the dates there. And we also have the mysterious Faction 6 that I've been hearing some really interesting guesses as to what Faction 6 is going to be. And I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but my absolute favorite guess so far was Space Dragons.
Space Dragons!
Space Dragons, yes. I'm not going to call out who it was, but that is my favorite guess as far as what Faction 6 is.
I would love Space Dragons. I mean, you're never going to find argument for me. There's a fair chance that if it involves fantasy, you're going to make a lot of people happy as soon as you go dragons.
Probably so.
Hey, Monpok, we got Space Dragons. You can borrow some of ours. Like, there's no... the Dragon Armada.
You do, actually. You have a lot of Space Dragons.
We can get some crossover models going.
There you go. We do have a dinosaur.
Oh, yeah. I like it.
One dinosaur in Warcaster, and I am so proud of him.
They are amazing looking, too. So, with that being said, I think we have run aground here at the end of this segment. Would you like to give any shout-outs, parting shots, anything you want to say?
I would love to hear from you guys. Let us know what you think about the campaign, what you like, what you don't like. We are here for you guys, and this whole narrative thing is not going away anytime soon. So Let us know how you like it.
Whether you like it or not. Awesome. I would love to end it right here with you saying,
roll those drums.
Boom. How's it going, everyone? And welcome back. In this last and final segment, I am joined by two amazing community members who I'm really excited to bring onto Primecast and spotlight what we have going on. We're going to talk some Monsterpocalypse releases and also just a little bit about the fun, cool things going on in the community. So I'm bringing on Daniel and David. How's it going, gentlemen?
Pretty good. This is Daniel Cooley.
Doing good over here, too. This is David.
Welcome, gentlemen, and really excited to bring you on. Daniel just recently had a awesome launch for his new Monsterpocalypse-focused web blog called Smash U. Is that correct, Daniel?
Yeah. So I am the developer of Smash Real University. It is a free online resource for both new and experienced players of Monsterpocalypse. For now, the website largely hosts a bunch of community resources, along with articles covering various topics from spoilers to strategy. We even have a few fan fictions. Eventually, we will also be hosting a community editable wiki. Overall, the website is intended to bridge the gap between a player's first exposure to the game when they play that first demo, read the rule book, or maybe watch one of the how-to videos, to the bleeding edge of the competitive meta, and everything in between.
And you just had an article release, you know, basically as we were recording this episode today. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, so that was the Units 101 article. It is going to be part of a really basic series of articles that are intended to bring a player, again, from that very first exposure to just being able to read the other articles that might cover slightly more advanced topics on strategy that are scattered throughout the rest of the Smashville University website.
Awesome. I love it. It's super exciting to see more community content being created and also to see that there are things for new players to help bridge that gap into learning more about the game and figuring out, you know, that fog of war, so to speak. And we also brought on David, aka Volneris. Many of you might recognize him from the Discord, where he is a prominent community member, constantly offering advice and giving feedback. We have a very active Discord where people are happy to engage and talk about our community. And I'm really excited to bring Volneris on here because the man comes up with some craziness sometimes, just some off the wall, exciting stuff. And so combined, the two of you are going to give me some interesting feedback and we're going to share some excitement about the new releases and talk about Monsterpocalypse.
Absolutely. Excited to be here.
So let's dive into the two of you as players first. Before we get into the crunchy bits about the Monpoc releases, let's talk about the host. You know, one of the best things about the game is the community members, is getting to hang out with people and get to know them. And I have to say, as a podcaster, it's one of my favorite things as well, is just to get to hang out with people and get to know them. So I sent you guys some questions ahead of time just to go over what we were going to ask. And so up first, Daniel, you've already told us that you are the progenitor of Smash U and that you know a lot about the game, but you know, who are you? What do you play? Why do you play it? Do you have a preferred agenda?
Sure. So I am a competitive player in the Monsterpocalypse community. However, I did pretty recently start playing the game as a whole. I moved over from War Machine last year during the spring, which is already a pretty competitive game. So I was ready to dive in as soon as I got into Monsterpocalypse. One of the first games that I ever played was during the TTS events number 13, which was really only like 8 months ago or something like that.
Yeah, two TTSs ago.
Yeah, two TTSs ago. So it really wasn't all that long ago. But I got really into the game. I really like all of the resource management that there is, figuring out when you want to use your action dice to summon something, to step, to attack, and how you want to allocate your power dice, and just all of that part of the game. It provides a lot of crunchiness that I really enjoy as a player. I tend to play lists that are going to mess with the dice a lot. I really love rerolls. I really love making sure that your dice pool is limited. Anything that's going to help me, you know, limit the number of dice that you have, especially in your power pool, is going to be something that I'll play. If you look at my current competitive list in the TTS event, you'll see that I'm playing Armadax and Stomatovorous Rex, both of which are pretty good at generating power. And then Stomatovorous Rex is good at keeping my opponent's power dice in check.
That lines up with what you played at LVO as well. While you were playing Destroyers there, you were playing lots of rerolls and, you know, the economy control. And so I can definitely see that.
That's right. Yeah, my previous list was a Destroyers list that had Dynastivus and the God of Vimana, which is a lot of rerolls, a lot of ensuring that my attacks are consistent and accurate, and hopefully trying to ensure that yours are not. Right now, I'm a lot more interested in Protectors than I am in Destroyers. It's not because I think Destroyers are bad or anything. It's just that I really love the update to Stomatovorous Rex, and I want to play as much of him as I possibly can. He is just everything I could possibly want in a monster, and I'm in love.
I love hearing that. That's awesome. So let's turn the tables. Volnaris, David, let's hear it from you. Same questions. Who are you? What do you play? Why do you play it? And your preferred agenda?
Absolutely. So this is actually the first miniature game that I ever got into myself. Before this, I played a lot of smaller scale board games and card games semi-competitively, but not to the same degree that I ended up taking Monpok. I stumbled into it at a local game shop where I picked up a lot of my games. And ever since, I think the SSI was being made, and I've stuck around since. I pretty quickly switched over to Destroyers with Globicus, and have stayed over there for the most part as far as what I like. But I do really like pretty much anything with movement or control options. I guess as far as what I play goes, I think this will be good to talk about just between the two of us, because I tend to focus much more on the spatial manipulation and building control. I'm starting to work on an article for Daniel's Smash U as far as the one junk building list. But a lot of my strategies tend to focus around controlling the action dice economy, as well as the overall building toolbox, creating as many options for my own use during my turns and limiting my opponent's actions. Stuff like Propaganda, Magistrate, a couple of lists I really like, or anything to do with Connie or Queen, mostly some combination of Master of the Eighth with something else. As far as my actual play goes, I joined in the online community when I think Preceptor had just come out. So right at the first EU. And I've been playing in the online TTSs since, as well as the Rooftop Rumble event over in Philadelphia for the full year that it was active. Probably the list I've had the most success with ended up being Sling User Magistrate. Those two are just a very funny pair together as a hard control shell. But right now in the current TTS, I'm running the Conductor with Makostos. I really like some of the fun stuff Makostos has to offer as kind of a very aggressive alpha-focused monster. And I am also cooking for the next TTS, a very unique hunter-focused list, I should say. But preferred agenda is definitely Destroyers. I do have a couple of things in particular I really like in Protectors, especially the newest ancient ones. There's enough units and buildings that I tend to prioritize that it keeps me in Destroyers for the most part.
Awesome. You mentioned Sling User there. I mean, you are definitely one of the community's go-to like resources when it comes to some Sling User tech.
Yeah. So. I really like Constrictor. There's a lot of things on the card that I happen to like, but I tend to be drawn. It's one of the things that they'll joke about all the time, but I tend to be drawn to some of the more unique rules on certain monsters. I prioritize my focus a lot on the units and the buildings in the game. They're what actually attracted me to it, along with the action pool. But in my monsters, I tend to look for things that I can't get from the units and the buildings. And being able to stop steps, being able to heal or wall off my monster is something that I tend to gravitate towards.
Awesome. So it sounds like the two of you have very diverse backgrounds and how you approach the game and what your philosophy is. So I'm excited to see how you take to these new releases and where your thought is as far as what you want to play with them and how you see playing them. So first up, let's talk a little bit about the Char Ghoul, because this little unit has gotten quite a lot of buzz for a grunt unit. Daniel, do you want to talk about it first and tell us where you see this little guy fitting in for you?
Sure. So the Char Ghoul is one of the new waste units. It is a cost one grunt, like Klaas just said, speed 6 and defense 2, with the special rules all terrain, fireproof, and the big one, char. It has a range 3 blast that allows you to spend up to 2 action dice on it and gives you 1 boost die. But the big thing about this is really char, and maybe the fact that it's fireproof, because at least you can get it into hazards when you're wanting to screen a monster and things like that. And then being speed 6, you can really get it pretty far up the board if that is what you need to use it for. But char states that models adjacent to this model suffer -1 defense. Now you might notice that I didn't say enemy model or friendly model. It's just models. So this counts for buildings. It counts for your own friendly models. It counts for enemy models. It doesn't matter what it is. It just suffers -1 defense. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But how I've been using it is just kind of in addition to something like a Spyfly or a Destructomite, where I get that extra. Either I can use it so that I have one of my targets be at -2 defense between flank from a Destructomite or something like that, and char from the Char Ghoul, or I have 2 separate areas that I can apply that -1 defense, where one of them is, again, like a Destructomite and the other is the Char Ghoul. So it's really very versatile in how you want to use it, whether you want to be screening with it or just applying that defense debuff. And then if you do get close enough to an enemy model, that blast is actually fairly accurate. It's only a 2-1 blast, which is not normally considered very accurate, but if you do get that -1 defense to be applied, it can hit a defense 2 or 3 model with some regularity, which is pretty nice.
Awesome. So, David, you know, as a resident Sling Ooze player, this has to excite you a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this whole release is going to be very interesting to see how it shakes up the Sling Magistrate in particular, but Sling Ooze list in general. I think in Sling Ooze lists, I'm probably running 1 right now, but I could see myself bumping up to 2 with a little bit of testing, namely just for the ability that it is fireproof. Mm-hmm. Being able to cover as a utility piece, Sling Oozers need to defend himself with Gravid, as well as the list just kind of struggles getting units to screen on hazard spaces. Being able to have that quick unit that can reach those little places, get into the fire and stick in there and hang in the way of the opponent is great as a defensive tool. And then char being able to back it up if it does live and make things a little more accurate, easier to hit considering it has only 3 blues in its power set. Outside of Sling Ooze lists, kind of in conjunction with what Daniel was saying, it is really self-unit agnostic, I would say. It can handle itself on its own, and it excels when it can be combined with 2 or 3 other defense downs or blue boost buffs. The other list that I'm cooking up involves trying to stack as many of those as possible. So I actually think the Char Ghoul was the last missing piece that I was kind of hoping for, but didn't expect to get towards completing that list.
Nice. You know, one of my favorite things about the Char Ghoul is both how the rule char lines up with Big Daddy Globicus, right? Because Globicus has Envelop on its own, which is that defense debuff, but it also allows you to create this kind of clear line of play of understanding what the wastes are and how they interact with the game and what you can expect from that faction. And so that is one of my favorite little pieces that tie it all together. So let's reverse the order here. David, do you want to talk about the Miasmist for us?
So the Miasmist is a very interesting specialist, sharing stats with its counterpart over in Protectors, the Air Avatar. It's a 7 high mobility, 3 defense. It can get to a lot of corners with its flight and kind of hang out there. Its main rule that people are real excited about is the new countermeasure, which gives each enemy unit within 2 spaces of it the debuff that they can't have their stats increased higher than the numbers printed on its card. This can theoretically help a lot with dealing with Drakken Berserkers or some of the more unique unit buffs that have been coming around lately to kind of stick in there and help with the unit versus unit game. It also has Drain Life, which is kind of a unique little tech piece that if it's next to enemy models or enemy monsters, they can't heal, which if that catches someone off guard, could be very funny. And also has on its blast attack, which is also a range for two blues, which is not bad for a specialist. It also has energy sap. So if it goes and combines with other units and hits an enemy monster, it can force them to move an action die from the monster pool to the unit pool, which I find very funny. being able to threaten the ability to hurt chains or yank action dice from monster pool to unit pool and deny them the resources to continue to attack you is very funny to me.
It's very waste.
Oh yeah, absolutely. As far as Insling user lists, I think this again fits as a solid one copy of in the list. Being able to threaten dropping it after being hit or preemptively toss it early on in the game forces your opponent to deal with it. It can get in the way in a sticky situation where they really needed it to not be there. Again, having flight means that it can function as another piece in the kit to hang out in those risky hazard spots and get in their way during a combo. And having countermeasures, again, means that it can kind of help out the other units that you'll usually have a lot of stay alive against the enemy.
Who would have guessed the waste engineering sticky situations?
Oh, absolutely. And then outside of it, I did a little bit of poking around with the energy sap. I think sliding one into another list and using its other tools, but having the availability for energy sap for a combined attack and a blast focused list, combined with the Propo Walker, can offer a lot of surprise energy dice draining from a destroyer's list.
Oh, absolutely. Something that was lacking a little bit in the past as well.
Yes, I'm pretty excited to have a few more of those tools to get an extra edge in controlling your opponent's action pools. Being able to even slide or shift a couple of those dice around can really help out in the tight like mid to end game where those action dice matter a lot.
Absolutely. So, Daniel, you ready to smash you with this unit?
Yeah. So I think that I will end up using the Miasmus quite a bit differently than David here will. I am mostly interested in the fact that it is speed 7, high mobility, defense 3, and has the amazing countermeasure ability. I am going to be using this almost every single turn one that I have, especially when it is combined with the next thing that we'll be talking about, the Toxic Waste Depot. Because if you can get this Miasmus out as a cost one unit, it is just excellent. It is incredibly fast. You can move through pretty much anything with high mobility and land on a lot of different types of places with flight. And there are several power zones on many of the maps that are 7 spaces away from the nearest spawn point. And so it is really nice that destroyers now have access to something that is as hard to kill as the Miasmus that can get to those on your first turn, especially. Because not only is it defense 3, but countermeasure means that enemy models can't gain more boost dice than what are already on their card when they're going against the Miasmus. So if they have something like a Skull Bat or something along those lines, that might otherwise increase the accuracy of their attack against the defense 3 model. They aren't going to be getting that against this model, which is just very nice to me.
Absolutely. I think that it's one of the most interesting pieces to come out in a long time, in that the duality of it being a tech piece and also a offense piece. You know, it is a defense point holder and it is a possible monster, you know, denial piece. There's so many different ways to look at this unit. And that means that at least throughout the game, you'll find different opportunities to spawn it, which is really what you want out of a unit, is to be able to say, for this situation, I can play it, but also in this situation, and also in this situation. Because too often, as we have, you know, run into with plenty of games where you're just like, man, I could really use an attacker right now. Or, gee, if I just had that one point holder extra. And so this model fills so many roles that you only have to just dig deeper into your resource pool for that two costs.
Definitely. And while I don't think that it's going to end up being an auto include or anything like that, it is incredibly versatile, as you said. So I think it will end up in a lot of lists.
Right on. Well, there is something that I think is going to end up in everybody's lists, and that is the Toxic Waste Depot. So, Daniel, you want to tell us about the Toxic Waste Depot?
Definitely. So the Toxic Waste Depot is certainly going to end up being one of my favorite buildings. It is a defense 7 building with the special rules metastasize, no fly zone, and of course it is the waste base. So I'm going to start off with metastasize, which says during your unit activation, this model can spend one action die to perform a metastasize action. Place a one-cost unit from your reserves into play adjacent to a unit of the same faction that you control. So what this means is that you could have, for instance, in Protectors, which is what I'm playing right now, you could have an Interceptor move up to the board on your first turn. It could spawn out a Sunfighter, for instance, using this metastasize action, which could then go another 7 spaces up the board, which is covering the overwhelming majority of the board space on most maps. And then it could still use the incredible transport action to bring out another C-type Shinobi that can then go to yet another power point. So even though the Toxic Waste Depot is the waste base, and so you might be thinking about it more in Destroyer's lists than Protector's lists, the versatility of that metastasize action is going to make it be seen in way more than just one or two Destroyer's lists. One thing that I definitely want to hit on with that metastasize action as well is how relevant it is for the rather large number of players that there are that are playing faction peer lists. A lot of factions don't have very many movement tricks, but if you have this Toxic Waste Depot in your list, you now have access to that incredible metastasize action, which is, you know, just a global movement buff for any faction that you might be playing. So I definitely would look at including one of these Toxic Waste Depots if you are kind of more into that faction peer side of Monsterpocalypse. So the Toxic Waste Depot also pairs very well with a building that was recently in the 2023 yearly update, the Void Gate, because it has the amazing special rule and power, which says that you can replace one allied unit with a unit of the same faction with cost 2 or less from your reserves. So between the Void Gates and power and metastasize from the Toxic Waste Depot, you really are getting quite a bit of benefit from running those more faction heavy or faction pure lists that I know a lot of players are running. So if you are one of those players, I definitely recommend picking up that Void Gate and the Toxic Waste Depot when it comes out as well. It's really kind of just nudge your list over into the slightly more powerful territory that you can get with those two abilities.
Absolutely. I think it allows you to combine with lots of different units and models that want to be in different places, but otherwise just don't have a good means to get there. There have been so few ways to, whether it's using Blitz or Tag, to move units up the board. And this allows you to create unit teams as well, where you can have a fast unit move up and then deliver maybe a slower support unit, or deliver a, you know, debuffing unit like the Char Ghoul, for example. And so I think that it is going to open up a lot of lines of play that just previously we weren't seeing. And so I think even with like unit elites, for example, that might be really fast and get up there and then allow you to spawn the grunt and then have the combination of them both be very accurate.
Yeah, my personal favorite of those combinations is using the metastasize action on an Explodahawk that has gone very far up the board to get a crawler out. Because they're incredibly slow, but they're also incredibly hard to kill. So if you can get them that far up the board onto one of your opponent's power zones, that's a really funny trick.
Oh, absolutely. Blitz and explode a hawk up. And then I like to metastasize out a Destructomite. So that 3 boost dice, 1 cost unit is also going to get that sweet flank bonus. And then even if the Destructomite doesn't attack, it's still hanging out on a PowerPoint or something being a Destructomite.
Definitely, you just have that trade-off between whether you want something that's hard to kill up there or you want a more efficient attack.
Absolutely. So, David, Bolneris, I know that the denial aspect of this building has to have you just tingling.
Absolutely. So, something I find really funny along with this, not only the significant unit discounts, being able to discount to waste while also providing a spawn much further up as an action, is the no-fly zone rule. The models cannot move through this model. In a list that is much more focused around moving buildings around, getting them into key places, using ISB or the conductor, or even just as a tech utility piece, I really like placing these, whether it's 1 or 4, all over the midfield and in key spots that I want to be able to say, this monster can't go through here, or even these units can't move through this area. There are a number of maps where being able to place 1 toxic waste during the draft and then slide over another one after a very important monster turn can completely shut off avenues or make it easier to protect your own monsters or even your backline just by saying the enemy can't move through after you've already gone through. It offers a very unique way to handle the building draft. And so whether or not you're even interested in the waste or the discounting part of it, just being able to play around with all of the movement and movement denial options there can cause a lot of havoc for you and your opponent in a lot of fun ways. On top of the fact that having them through the area and even multiple places means that when you've pushed up more aggressively or made these other attacks or later on in the game, as you have easier access to your units, being able to secure those out of nowhere in the midfield and raise new havoc, get new discounts, keep the pressure going on your opponent without needing it to be in your backline can cause a lot of excitement.
Absolutely. You know, and for somebody who loves abilities like Constrictor and Grappler, this has to be, you know, right up your alley for all of those extra denial tools. One thing I like about how it accentuates the waistline of play is that you have things like Envelop and Constrictor and Char and now No Fly Zone. And so you can give your opponent decisions on which avenue of approach they want, but none of them are good. How do you approach a toxic waste spill? Well, very carefully and with some gloves, apparently.
Absolutely. And really being able to offer different ways to slow down or interrupt your opponent as they're making a big play can help you devise your own and look for that right avenue to catch them off guard with a really high damage play.
You can do some crazy things with Globicus as well, being able to place baby Globicus after he splits around a waste depot that they then can't go and access baby Globicus.
Absolutely. I'm particularly a fan of being able to move through an area and then use an ISB right at the end of the turn to completely block off a spot, or taking advantage of the smog factory from a year or two ago to be able to move through them anyways. Just put them all in a big clump so the enemy can't move through. And right when they think you're stuck as well, you're not. Glavicus just moved 6 right through all of it. Being able to throw itself real far with that. But I'm just a big fan of the different strategies that have to come forward because the opponent is presented with a new limitation. Being presented with it yourself also has its challenges, But if you're ready for it and you have the tools that you've come into the match prepared with, you can turn those into a huge advantage for you.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like we have talked quite a bit about the application and understanding of these buildings and the units and kind of how you see it fitting in. But I'm going to open up the floor here at the end. Do you have any questions for me as, you know, developer? Do you have any thoughts you want to share or excitement that you want to talk about before we roll into the end here?
I did have one curious one just to start us off. I guess we'll go with the units for starters. What kinds of other versions of these went through as in the testing?
You know, everybody wants to peek behind the curtain, right? They always want to look under the hood and see how it all runs. One thing I will say is that we tested them for a long time. We went through lots of different iterations, and trying out different iterations sometimes is going to various extremes of that unit. You know, was the defense correct? Was the speed correct? Was the ability both thematic and correct for the lines of play and interesting and pushing people into trying new things? One thing that we're seeing now in Monsterpocalypse, especially with this release, is just the myriad amount of interesting new combos that you can do in our current state of the game. And so also trying out different permutations to say, was this the most fun version of this that we came out with? Was this the one that hits the meta in the right way? And by that, I mean, you know, we look at the recent releases and the things peripheral to that and the things in the future of that and the things for years to come. And we wonder, you know, is this the perfect piece to check and look at all those other pieces and understand how that piece all fits together?
Absolutely.
And then the one thing I will also say is we have really dialed in on what the power level of a piece should be. And in some pieces, we push a little bit, and some pieces, we take a little bit away. And I think here, you know, the Toxic Waste Depot is an example of understanding that buildings themselves have to be secured and at the correct time and hopefully not destroyed, and sometimes invested further resources to repair and move around and all of these other things just to access the abilities or the strategies that you want. And so because that's such a heavy investment, a model like the Toxic Waste Depot can live at a very extreme end of what we might consider a powerful model and still be very balanced by the type of model it is and how we interact with those models. And then some other models like the Charcoal might be really interesting and seem powerful up front, but as you play, the layers of understanding that char can be a two-edged sword and it can hurt you, or suddenly you accidentally stand next to a building that you didn't want to give -1 defense to and your opponent takes advantage of that. And so all of those balancing factors help bring it together to understand that the power level can be pushed in certain ways when balanced against other factors.
Absolutely. I mean, I've mentioned it a handful of times in the community itself, but I think the building releases have always been my favorite personally. I think they change up a lot about how the game can be played and is played with both people. And even just a single purchase can often change the experience that every table is provided for months to come. As a follow-up, which of these is your favorite personally to run?
Ooh, Toxic Waste Depot is the model, like, you can never find the bottom of the bag of tricks on that model. I feel like every game I use it in a different way, whether it's metastasizing out different units or taking advantage of no fly zone, or even just thinking about the different applications and making me change my list and say, huh, you know, this would be really cool if I metastasized that out. And then you go down this rabbit hole and you end with like a whole different construct than you started with. And you're like, did I just build a whole list around this one ability? That's probably not the right approach. but boy, is this fun. And then you kind of back off of that a little bit, and then you find that sweet spot where it's just enough synergy and strategy, but not so much that you're like, I just built a whole list around this ability. And that's the great thing about, you know, that building is you can continually dive deep into the lists of strategies and come up with something new.
I definitely have to say that I have really liked how versatile a lot of the newly released or newly updated buildings are. And not just in how they function when you have them secured, but the fact that you can even put them in different spots of the map to have a different effect on how that game plays out.
Absolutely.
We obviously see this with the Toxic Waste Depot with no fly zone, but I also feel the same way about the multi-dimensional apartment building that just
The league was building.
Teased. Yeah, the league building. That building is so fascinating. You can stick it in your back line to get extra power dice, or you can just put it in the middle of the board and just say, hey, if you just start destroying apartments, then this guy's just going to jump around, and it's going to be really interesting to try to figure out where that ephemeral building is going to end up and how it can change how your monsters access each other. And then before that, for the yearly update, the Jungle Fortress getting the
Rampart.
The Rampart rule. Yeah, where you don't roll boost dice when making power attacks against it. So not only does it have the already great patrol base action, but now it is also something you can consider just slapping down in the middle of the map and saying, well, if you would like to attack this in order to gain easier access to one of my monsters, you're going to have to spend a lot for it or make it a more a less efficient attack. Maybe you have to brawl it or blast it instead of
ram it
like you would actually want to.
Hit it with us. Yeah, absolutely. I think
the newer buildings are.
And some of that is just the deep understanding of how monsters move around and interact with the map, right? And part of that is also having explored these buildings and putting the draft out over and over and over again, and knowing that there needs to be some ways for buildings to offer different things to the list, whether they are secured or not. And I think the multidimensional apartment building is a perfect example of that, because pedestrians often look at all of the high mobility and flyer models and they're just like, are we, you know, the redheaded stepchildren? Have you forgotten about us? But then you look at buildings like the MDAB and like the Singularity, and these things offer movement lanes where you're like, oh, if I were playing a pedestrian and I put this building here, now I can pass through this lane without having to worry about hopping over it or destroying it. And that is the deeper level of play that we see a lot of the, when you, I think you referred to it earlier, Daniel, as the bleeding edge of the meta building into their list.
Also particularly a fan of the double pedestrian list, being able to take advantage of their supposed weakness to catch their opponent off guard, being able to show up front to the opponent, oh, I don't have high mobility or flying like you do, I can't get around these buildings, and then right when they don't expect it, slide a myriad into place or a smog factory or even just shift a unit out of the way to take advantage of the fact that they weren't ready for you to go in at that moment.
Absolutely. So I have a question. I'm going to turn the tables on you now. What is a release recently that has you looking at an older release in a completely new way? Like, what is it that came out that you're like, man, I want to reach back for that model immediately. I can't wait to play it again because of the new release that just hit.
Yeah, I would definitely say from the most recent release, it'd be the Chargul and getting me to actually like Phobos. I'd completely overlooked him at start, but Chargul and just another access to a defense down on Destroyers makes a very funny Phobos Mogroth list that really lets Phobos shine in a new way.
Ooh, I like it.
There's a 6 Hunter list floating around in the list builder that is built entirely around getting all the units right where they need to be so that you can get off 3-4 damage consistently on a unit turn that just completely throws the opponent off guard.
I think I own 4 hunters, so I'm pretty close to playing that list.
I'm collecting them. It's hard to pick them up, but my goal is to eventually be able to play this list live.
That would be amazing. How about you, Daniel?
So I have a love-hate relationship with all of the new junk buildings that have been coming out, or the ability to use them as junk buildings.
And so disruption buildings.
Yeah, disruption buildings that you just place in the middle of the map like we were talking about earlier. So I've actually been looking a lot at Taharka again. I think that he does a great job of getting around Rampart on the jungle fortresses, which we're starting to see a lot more of. Of course, you know, he's a pedestrian, so the playing field is sort of leveled a little bit. If the toxic waste depots start coming out more and we see more of those no-fly zones around. And so just with all of the new types of junk that are out, I think that having that juggernaut available is something that can really alter the way that your opponent has to think about the game, because typically they're going to be thinking about monsters that aren't rampaging across the city in order to do damage to them. I also really like him with the MDAB. Because then you are incentivized to bring more apartment buildings, and so you have a bunch of low defense buildings hovering around that Taharka can really take advantage of with those rampaging juggernaut plays.
Love it. Awesome. And you know, talk about a monster that like is just waiting to get unlocked, waiting for, you know, that one list or that one building that's just going to completely turn people on their head. So I'm excited to hear both of you have something that is just, I wasn't even considering this, and then boom. I think that for me, the updated Zor Maxim from the yearly update and the Shadow Sun updated units got me just like super reinvigorated to put some Shadow Sun on the table. And to further combine that with probably my favorite monster in the whole game, the Warden of Teokali, the amazing shenanigans of being able to move things around and put them on power points to be able to activate alignment and all of the actions that are going to be giving me providence, that list just is really fun and exciting to think about and play. But now, with the Toxic Waste Depot being able to metastasize units, the Shadow Sun can be anywhere they want, anytime they want, offering jam with sun fighters and shadow riders that can shadows things up and then metastasize things out of that and then cargo off of that, and I can be all over the place. And lists like that just make me happy. I unnecessarily complicate the game sometimes for myself, but by the end of it, I've had a lot of fun.
Do you think that's probably the big part of the game is really just trying to see how many different avenues of play you can open up for yourself to shake things up for your opponent? I will also add to that Magna was actually the first monster I played, and the one that I gravitated towards just for the hit and run on power. I think the rework to her was very graceful and really added a lot of unique ways to play and bring her to the table with different lists. Definitely the top of my list on Protector side for messing around with some of the other pairs like Queen or, again, Warden as well.
Absolutely. And I think that is exactly what we're going for with every single release, is just allow you to look at all of your toys and say, how does this give it new life? How does this reinvigorate things? And how does it shake up the game? And then also, you know, I know as we have seen continually and new players joining our Discord, joining our Facebook, asking questions, getting involved, these new releases are great for new players because you're going to get the most mileage out of those, you know, first few packs, whether you're playing focused on an individual faction or just, you know, even if you only bought 4 packs and you had 20 units, now you have at least 5 units from each of those packs that can be jumping out of each other and doing crazy things with the metastasize. And the entry level couldn't be better right now.
I definitely agree with that. As someone who hadn't played miniature games at all before this, I was very pleasantly surprised by the buy-in even back then. And I would say with all the resources the community's provided and the new packs having a lot of very useful pieces across the board, it's much easier to comfortably say that you can just pick up 4 unit packs, 2 monsters, and a handful of buildings that you happen to like, and just run with it. That's how we played during all of COVID, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, new resources like Smash U coming out with their new player articles. So we're going to see some opportunities for people to explore things that they haven't even tried yet. And for things to come to, we've got Xerox right on the horizon. And that monster has no agenda, can play for both sides of the game. And it's a copycat monster. It lets you play with more of your army. And so the opportunity to pick up more monsters, play with more monsters, and experience more monsters is going to be both an exciting adventure for new players who just want to try out new things, and for the veteran player who looks at the different combinations of monsters and goes, how can this guy and that guy play together? What is that like? What if I use this ability and that ability? How do I get the most out of my end game? And so I think that monster is just going to offer so much versatility to players. And then we also have Archipelago and the new Triton units right around the corner, which, you know, I can't wait for those to hit the table, because players are just going to be picking their jaw up off the floor for how cool and fun they are and how beautiful those models look.
Yeah, just from the previews, I love Archipelago so much. He has one of the coolest models that's been released since I've been playing the game. I love that he has a derelict ship on his back. It's just really exciting, a nice design for a Triton model. And I also really like I don't remember what they're called, the whales with arms.
The Orca Enforcers.
Yeah, I know not everybody likes their aesthetic, but I just love it.
Thank you. I do love the Orca Enforcer. Big whale, angry whale, muscly whale, ready to put some things to sleep. And the thing is, all the rules on those models slay. Like, I really feel like we are really hitting a stride with some of the best things that have ever been released. And the waste base and the waste units are the, you know, precursor to what's to come next. And the hype couldn't be higher.
I'm definitely excited to see how they play with the newly updated Leviathron. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, I think we have finally come to the end of this episode. So that only leaves us with one final thing to say. You know what it is. You want to say it?
Try. Roll drums.
Roll drums.
What happened to being in stereo? You were
supposed to be at the same time.
Our precursor, our practice, you were simultaneous, and then we were just like, are we supposed to do this?
What happened? It was supposed to be a dramatic lead into, and
okay. We're gonna get this right. Deep breaths. We're gonna coach our way through it. Here we go. All of the audience, everybody listening to, I want you to help us with this one, because this is our anniversary episode. So for 1 year, we have been saying it together, and you're going to say it with me now. On 3, 2, 1, roll drums.